This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. War is generally pretty bad for the environment. And understandably, the environment is not necessarily the military's top priority when at war. But more Navy officials are now asking questions about how to be less destructive on the environment, especially when that environment supports an important industry like fisheries and aquaculture. Chris Reddy is a marine chemist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution who specializes in oil spills. He was one of the key scientists who responded to the Deepwater Horizon disaster in 2010. Last year, he got an unsolicited email from a Navy lieutenant commander asking for his help. Chris, it's always good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Okay, so about a year ago, you get this email from a Navy lieutenant commander. I mean, just totally out of the blue?
I think it was forwarded to me from the HUI, general mailbox, but eventually found it to me, yes.
And what were they asking for?
He was a planner, this lieutenant commander, and he asked me if I could help him in a large NATO exercise called Cold Response 2016. And I immediately saw the opportunity for an academic to reach out to a Navy personnel who wanted my input.
Scientists at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution have collaborated with the Navy in a number of ways over the years,
yeah.
But this is something new for you, right?
This was a great opportunity for us to, we keep thinking or talking about exchanging business cards and learning about different cultures. The idea to reach out to a naval officer to talk about oil spills to me was exciting. And so I immediately said, hey, let's get on the phone.
And does the Navy have any sort of internal, have they ever considered the idea of oil spills or contamination, environmental contamination
in
their operations?
The Navy has a very good infrastructure about the oil spills. They also rely heavily on the NOAA, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, for input as well. But this Navy officer was also looking for other perspectives, and he reached out to me.
So explain a little bit more about the exercise that they wanted your help with. What was the oil spill risk? Was it just from ships driving around, or was there a more specific risk?
There was a specific aspect that Norway was split in half, and the lower aspect was being represented
So this is a simulation. Norway
was a simulation. This was over 10 countries, ships, tanks, airplanes, United States Marines representing the United States being involved in a simulated war, for lack of a better term, in which Norway got split in half. The southern aspect of Norway was the NATO ally, and the northern aspect was an aggressor, for lack of a better term. The big concern was that they wanted in their planning to sink one of the aggressors' oil tankers that would be refueling some of their vessels on site. But when they were in the planning stages, they started to recognize that the economic blowback and potentially also just the perception and the relationships that they had with their allies could be huge, because if they spilled the oil in the wrong place, it would demolish or completely ruin their aquaculture and fisheries.
So, the North Atlantic is huge fishery.
Yeah, I mean, the statistics on Norway's economy built off fisheries and aquaculture are huge. And so it was interesting to me, because we usually think about avoiding infrastructure, especially in Iraq, afterwards about highways and clean water and hospitals and all these things that we think about from avoiding damages to infrastructure because it creates unrest. And this Navy officer is asking me about how do we avoid the infrastructure of a fishery in a coastal environment so that it limits damages to the inhabitants.
I have to say, when I first heard about this, in part, my reaction was going way back in history, right, to like salting fields after an army has come through to make sure that nothing can grow. And I guess I hadn't really thought about the environmental impact of modern warfare.
Yeah, no, it was very exciting to me in his first email to talk to me about the idea that they were worrying about limiting damages because of lessons learned from if you over damage the infrastructure, you will create unrest and also bigger problems down the line when this perhaps skirmish ended. And so I thought this was quite forward thinking on the Navy and an excellent opportunity for me to help, because I am funded by the United States government.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Chris Reddy of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about his recent collaboration with the Navy. So when they actually went to do this simulation, were you there in person?
Oh, no. No, I mean, I wrote a small piece about it. It probably took longer for me to write the small piece than it did for me for my interactions. It was a series of phone calls and emails, and also a series of emails that I wrote introducing this lieutenant commander to other folks who might help him. So it was mainly phone calls and emails about the exercise while they were planning, not necessarily. I wasn't in some war room.
So what kind of recommendations did you give them? If you're going to sink an oil tanker, how do you do it in the least damaging way possible?
I mean, the first thing that when I got, first of all, it was really quite interesting. He was so far up and on such a high latitude when I said, hey, let's get on the phone right now. He said, you know, first of all, I only have internet and phone call for a couple hours of the day based on where they were in terms of their satellite capacity to communicate. So we had to work around when we could talk on the phone. And then one of the first things he said is, hey, I got to avoid the next Deepwater Horizon. I mean, that was his perception, was that sinking one tanker was going to create what they saw on CNN 6 years earlier. And I quickly rest assured to him that that wasn't the problem.
Just not enough oil in one tanker?
Yeah. No, I mean, the scale would be insignificantly smaller. But then I also reminded him that oil spills were like buying a house. It was location, location, location. So it is important to consider that even though a small volume may be released, it's wise to avoid these damages. And that was what was so impressive. But, you know, my next, you know, there were a couple aha moments, but the most important was I asked him, I said, are you with, you know, the environmental aspect of the Navy? And he said, no, I blow blank things up. I mean, he was a planner who just was being tasked to say, when do you blow up this tank so that we limit damages? And so that's how our conversation started, which is, okay, you're going to have to blow this up as part of your exercise. Great. Okay. That's understood. Our big concern is, how do we avoid hurting the fisheries and the aquaculture so that those damages don't occur or are minimalized? And so we talked about all the different inputs that could affect that. But I mean, that was, you know, the first start was him asking me their challenges and how I could help them.
So you guys have these phone calls. You talk about, you know, the size of the tanker, the kind of oil, whatever. You write up this report that says, here's how you could limit some of your damages. They go and do the exercise. Presumably they blew up the tanker. Was there follow-up?
The tanker wasn't blown up per se. I mean, they had designated that this was the best time, but there was no torpedoes on the way. Even though there were a lot of equipment and personnel on site, there wasn't per se, but in this case it was a simulation. No, he immediately let me know that they did it. I basically said, you want to do this when the tide's going out and at the, you know, when the best is when the oil is getting moving away from shore. I mean, this wasn't particularly novel in terms of the advice, but, you know, just trying to figure out a good time when the tide was going out, the winds were blowing out, every aspect that we could provide a means that we were as far away from the coast as possible and that the winds and the currents would also drive it away.
You mentioned that, you know, you wrote up this report for them. I wonder how that compares to the process you usually go through of doing often a years-long research project and then writing up a publication for some scientific journal.
No, I mean, Jason Zeebold, who was the lieutenant commander, he wrote a report up and I helped him edit it. And then I took what he wrote and then I wrote it for a more popular piece with Oceanographic's online Oceanus magazine. And then I also wrote it for another science kind of popular the American Geophysical Union's online magazine. So there were an official report and then me kind of taking some of that official report and then put it in the context of how academia can appreciate this outcome.
Well, what do you think that there are in terms of benefits? You mentioned this idea of kind of seeking out different perspectives, different cultures, essentially, within science between military and academia. I mean, do you see this continuing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the biggest things that people learned from the Deepwater Horizon in particular was you don't exchange business cards at a crisis. And now I've built a relationship with this one Navy commander, but also that we now, you know, hopefully it got through the chain that you know, we can be there for them to ask them these questions. But, you know, the other thing that we have to remember is that, you know, obviously everybody would say, okay, you gave them some advice on a plan. But plans never follow through. But to be honest with you, you're more likely to edit and change a plan if it's starting to go wrong if you have a good relationship with your partners already. And so this is the type of relationships that we want to build, so that even if you have a plan that has to be changed, you want to be nimble enough. And those nimble enough is when you understand the cultural backgrounds of your players. And this is so critical. I see this every day in oil spill crisis science.
Just that people don't know each other well enough before you hit the crisis point.
Look, you know, I have 7 years to get tenure. Somebody who's deciding to when or not they're going to disperse the oil or burn the oil has 7 hours to make that decision. I need to get 90% or better certainty for a paper to be considered decent. You know, an on-scene coordinator who's running the oil spill, which is either a Coast Guard captain or an admiral, often will be very happy with 70% certainty because that's better than nothing and they're in a crisis.
I was going to guess 50-50 in a lot of cases.
Oh, yeah, 50.
Would probably
be
good.
I mean, they'll take whatever they can get as long as it's bounded by, you know, what confidence it is and whether or not it's going to grow in. And in some respects, this is a big giant challenge to academia, because the idea of delivering to somebody on the record 60% certainty, I mean, that gives a chill up a lot of people's backs. But other people would be perfectly happy to do that if it's better than nothing.
I mean, you've been talking about this in terms of very physical crises, an oil spill.
Yeah.
But a week or so ago, thousands of scientists gathered in Boston for the American Association for the Advancement of Science annual meeting. And I have to say, it felt like a community in crisis, saying, oh my gosh, the political and cultural times that we're living in, science is under attack, and we need to start reaching out and creating relationships, creating new relationships. Sounds like, to your point of view, though, it's too late already.
Yeah, I think it is a little too late. But I also think that, but the first step also is to understand that each one of these players in any type of relationships all have different metrics for success, wants, and needs. You know, a scientist wants good science to be out there. We want to get funded. We want this data to be used in a proper manner. Somebody else wants to get reelected. Maybe an industry person wants their stock to go up because the regulation is rescinded. And we have to appreciate all these different aspects before we understand that just because our science dictates this, that everything else should be put by the wayside.
So I'm curious what your thoughts are on the upcoming March for science. I mean, the science community is really divided on this one. Should scientists be marching in the streets in support of, in defense of the scientific endeavor? Or should scientists really in some ways be doubling down on kind of the older standard of, you know, stick to your good science, speak to politicians or to the public when asked, kind of a model?
You know, I struggle with this, and because I can sympathize with a lot of my colleagues, because they want to do something, right? I mean, you see this out in the newspapers and you want to do something. But, you know, I personally, the first thing I think about when I hear a march is that one reporter is going to get a scientist who isn't trained on how to communicate outside their peer group and is going to speak on behalf, in theory, just one of the thousands of scientists who might be marching, and create such a poor perspective and stereotype that in many respects it'll negate all the great efforts of trying to represent the scientists who are marching. Now, you might say that sounds negative, but in this fast-paced maze of social media, I see this as a bigger detriment. And so I think we have to be extremely strategic about how we move forward. And quite frankly, I think in the Washington, D.C. world, I feel much more comfortable with Rush Holt, who's now the president of the American Association for Science, who was 18 years as a representative and also has a PhD in physics, or Marsha McNutt, who is essentially now a Washington insider, who's now the president of the National Academy of Sciences. At that level, they should be our mouthpiece.
So you don't think the entire science community should be out there trying to make this case for
themselves? I think that before you want to get into this game, you have to understand the rules. And I think there's a moat around the ivory tower for a good reason. And I think that, now, with that said, I think that if you want to contribute, you have to start to think about this on a tiered level. And quite frankly, I think we're a little too late. I mean, if you really wanted to make an impact, then where are all these scientists trying to communicate? And I know some are already, so I'm being overly generalistic, but, you know, reaching out and trying to communicate and making apolitical good science information at their community level, and then gaining more, understanding different perspectives and groups, which would allow them to be more effective as they move up into larger, larger populations and more diverse populations. And that's why I think in Washington, D.C., it's such a tricky area. I would much more happy to see Marsha McNutt and Rosh Holt represent me than a scientist so good-willed coming off a bus who's going to get waylaid by the Twitter aspect.
I mean, that said, though, you write op-eds.
Mm-hmm.
You are very engaged with the public. You also, through both your Deepwater Horizon work and as we've just been talking about this newer example, you collaborate with the military, with industry, with various different sectors outside of academia. So clearly you do see a value to, as an individual scientist, being a voice in the broader sphere.
But you have to be aware of your strengths and weaknesses and your comfort zones. And you also have to understand the blowback of making a mistake. And, you know, the other thing, too, is not only do you have to understand your audience. In this case, I don't think we have a well-defined audience on this march. Are we marching to the lay public? Are we marching to the president? Are we marching to Congress? And how does that one single march resonate to all these different folks who we may be trying to reach out to? And how does an action like that be interpreted and used by each one of those stakeholders? This is a non-trivial, rather layered, tricky exercise. It's well-intended, but I think that it has to be very well thought out, because everybody thinks that getting funded is hard in science. I think going into Washington, D.C. is significantly harder.
So am I to take it you will not be marching?
No. I wish them the best, but I worry very much that the wrong scientist, well-intended, incredibly passionate, is going to poorly represent in a manner in which that there could be significant blowback and negate all these great efforts of passion that these people so badly want to do. They want science to be used properly and used and embraced, and I can sympathize with that. But it's not that easy.
Chris Reddy is a marine chemist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He specializes in oil spills, and last year he helped a Navy lieutenant commander with his plans for a large military exercise near Norway. Chris, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Next up, what it takes to breed aquarium fish in captivity. Hint, it's really not easy. That's when Living Lab continues after a short break.